Can you hang up?
Or turn them off.
Hey, guys on the phone? Are you there?
Oh, yeah, not lying.
They're having fun. That's yeah. Sure. Go ahead, Cameron. You were talking about my infinite wisdom.
So the only way I could do this is because of the efforts by Luke Whitman to develop a database where all of our survey data, not all, the majority of our survey data is collected in the field, is directly entered into a PDA, and then the PDA is synced to a computer in the office every day at the end of the surveys, and it populates the database. And all this is right here is a flat file extraction of data from the database. This gets a little bit to one of Dave. You're interested at some point in getting raw data. I've got to tell you that I don't think very many people on the planet can understand what to do with the genuinely raw data. So What you're seeing here is rawest of the raw, but it lets us say a few things about how we spent our summer vacation. So I'm going to do so. We conducted carcass surveys basically to get preformed mortality. We started those carcass surveys early in July. July 3rd was the first recovery of a carcass from any of the sub basins. Over the course of the season, towards the end of October, we collected 831 carcasses during carcass surveys. We also conducted spawning surveys at the same time, basically, with the spawning surveys. That's the next tab over. We get information on reds and red locations, but we again at the same time collect carcasses too. But so the actual carcass recovery is a sum of what we collect during carcass surveys and spawning surveys. The other things I'm going to chat about are some of the math that's involved with reducing these raw data down to things that are of interest to us: pre-spawning mortality estimates, proportion of heterogen spawners, run size estimates, and then we also operate counting stations at Lower Bennett, Upper Bennett, and at Lieber Dam. So I'm going to go through all of that. So diving right into the math, we have summary data for this year. That's right here for peak red counts. These four numbers right here are the peak counts of reds summed across all of the survey reaches that were surveyed. And they give us an index of the abundance of active spawners in those particular reaches. Those numbers are routinely expanded by a factor of 2.5 to get to something that's not entirely unlike a run size estimate. I prefer to work with just the red count data, because that's not, you're not adding in the uncertainty that's associated with that expansion factor of 2.5. For the purposes of discussion, I also threw in Lance's, scrubbed data for the McKenzie run size estimates over the last 10 years. That's what's in this row right here. And it's gets us to the point where we can say, looking at this figure right here to the left, the McKenzie had the highest red counts of any basin, Middle Fork, the lowest, North and South Santiam, somewhere in the middle. Okay? If you focus in on the McKenzie is the only one that appeared to have the Middle Fork, North Santiam, South Santiam. It's very similar to the outcome we got last year, but the McKenzie appears to have a decrease. No idea if it's statistically significant. None of that work has been done. The data need additional work. But this is 2012 right here.
Below the project?
No, this is exclusively below the project.
So above the project. The survey data, is it all below project?
All below project.
It's so all below.
CRFM-funded above project surveys are done, but we're still entering all the data for that.
Yeah. Below dams.
So below dams, right? So possible decrease in abundance of reds counted in the McKenzie. About two-thirds as high as the counts we got last year, just to give you some context. And that is not because we had a big change in any protocols. Part of it is because this doesn't include South Fork McKenzie counts. But no change in protocols, no change in personnel. It's probably a real number, and I'll get to that a little bit when I talk about
the passage. Cameron, just go to that McKenzie graph on the right.
Yeah.
Were there any changes in the hatchery program, release-wise, poundage, anything that would... Lance is shaking his head no already.
No, okay. Not pretty constant. right? It looks real. It looks real. If you look at the Liebert Dam counts, which Lance, you talked about, we'll get to that in a minute. Okay, red counts.
Did I miss the
Not yet. Working my way through. So, yeah. Start with pre-spawning mortality. Pre-spawning mortality is derived from inspecting female carcasses to see if they're full of eggs or not full of eggs. If they're full of eggs, they are pre-spawn mort. We collected a large number. The total during spawning surveys and carcass surveys was well over 800 carcasses, which female carcasses were inspected for spawning condition. Good sample sizes everywhere but in the Middle Fork, and a not insignificant sample taken from the Middle Fork. Only 56 female carcasses were recovered in the Middle Fork, which isn't surprising given the number of active reds we found down there. You just take the total number of unspawned females divided into the total females, and you get raw estimates of pre-spawning mortality that range from a low of 20% in the Mackenzie to a high of about 50% in the Middle Fork Willamette. These are, again, very similar to outcomes in a couple last year. The 20% pre-spawning mortality level in the Mackenzie is driven in large part by pre-spawning mortality below Liebert. Pre-spawning mortality above Liebert, especially up in what we treat as the wildfish refuge way up above this confluence of the South Fork is very, very, very low.
So population-wide, those are
population-wide, all below dams.
Yeah.
Okay, below dams. These bars are 95% confidence intervals. That is a pretty significant difference between the Mackenzie and everything else, and a pretty significant difference between the Middle Fork and everything else. But the North Santiam and South Santiam are very similar, kind of moderate. What we're treating is moderate pre-spawning mortality rates. These are hatchery wildfish together. We haven't in recent years seen any differences that are, you know, kind of really telling in pre-spawning mortality between natural origin and hatchery origin fish, so they're lumped here, but in the final analysis we'll parse them out and show them that again. I think we'll see that. When we get to handle all those carcasses, we also get to look at adipose fins, extract otoliths, and scan for coded wire tags. And when that's all said and done, we get a good idea of the total number of genuinely wild fish we handle and genuinely hatchery fish we handle. I don't have any of those data except the inspection of the fish for an adipose clip. So this is all based on adipose clipped, not validated or verified genuinely wild fish. The PHAS levels are just simply the number of ad clip fish divided by the total carcasses where we were able to inspect and decide whether the fish did or did not have an adipose fin. And same order as with the pre-spawning mortality, Mackenzie to the left, going over the South Santiam to the right. Mackenzie had the lowest PHAS level, but that again is driven by the very large, high abundance of hatchery fish below Liebert Dam. The PHAS levels above Liebert, especially way up high in the upper watershed, is a half of that or less. Right.
So Mackenzie looks quite a bit higher than normal.
A little bit. But if you just look at above Liebert, it's fairly normal. It's down in the 20% range.
Above Liebert.
Above Liebert. Right. Okay. Everything else is the way it's recently been. It's not 95%, but it's way up in the 70-80% range. And remember, those numbers all will go up once we look at unclipped fish that have thermal marks. So this is not a great story right here. This is kind of still high PHAS levels, but we try to look for concordances based on some comments you made a couple of years ago, to look for concordance between dam counts and survey results. So if we look at the proportion of clipped and unclipped fish in our video counts of Liebert, it should relatively speaking match. But we'll start up in the North Santiam. These are video survey results from Lower Bennett Dam on the North Santiam River, and relatively, it's just raw data, but if I've highlighted the counts for, right here, the bold numbers are the count of clipped fish and unclipped fish ascending Lower Bennett Dam and then getting up into the upper North Santiam. Okay, low numbers, not much use of the north channel of around Staten Island. by Chinook, more so by steelhead. But Upper Bennett, problematic logistically to operate that facility, but we did get some pretty good coverage, very, very, very low video outage, good counts of fish that were passed upstream or that made their way upstream to pass the video, and the AdClip fish are dominating, of course, 2,771 AdClip Chinook, 902 not marked Chinook, and it has to be adjusted a little bit for kind of unknowns, video images where you can't tell whether it did or did not have an adipose fin. I haven't done that.
So these are actual counts,
right? Raw counts. Net counts. You see the negative signs for October 1 through 6? That's a fallback.
So with Upper and Lower Bennett last year, we potentially could have had about 1,000 before checking the marks, but 1,000 wild fish returning.
Okay. Okay. These data need some massaging because of the logistic issues that were associated with our trapping of broodstock. There were many instances where relatively small numbers, but many instances of relatively small numbers of fish that were hand passed out of the trap into the upper watershed. And those are all buried because of lack of foresight on my part and these notes right here, one day at a time, and there's a long, 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 long list of them, and I have to go through that, parse it out into adjustments, basically, for the video counts. It's next year it's going to be different. We'll have that automatically collected, so it's much easier to decide. So more like what happens at Lieber, where we keep track of everything that gets handled out of the trap, removed, and stuff like that. So this is a Lieber data that you were asking about. Caveat about it, let me go all the way to the bottom, is that Hogensen has not finished entering all the data. The last data entry occurred on the 12th of September, and fish moves past then. So those are these are the totals as of 9/12/2012. If you'd make a mental guess about how many fish would have moved after that fact and compare those counts to the expansion of the red counts above Lieber, there's pretty close concordance. It's not a perfect bang-on match, but it's not way off either.
When do you finish up your spawning surveys in the south or the Mackenzie?
When the fish stop spawning, so...
It's
October 22nd.
Okay, because we just got a fresh fish in the Cougar trap yesterday.
And we got a notification that we had an angler saw fish down below Lieber, live, what they call spring chinook swimming around below Lieber. But we had a flow event, and it makes it impossible. We can't survey now. We're over. But that would be a little unusual. And those numbers, when you're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of reds and thousands of fish actually counted, I don't think that they have a big effect on our final estimates. I'm just checking with this set to make sure I had that right. October 22nd is our last successful survey. Okay.
You're done out there then, right, Tim?
Yeah.
Out planning our carcasses.
Go ahead. Okay. Carcass surveys got pre-spawning mortality levels similar to what we found last year. Lowest in the Mackenzie, highest in the Middle Fork, moderate in the North and South San Diego. PIOS levels are lowest in the Mackenzie, high in the Middle Fork, moderate in, but high, still high. Higher than you want them to be in the North and South San Diego. Back of the napkin calculations for expansions of the red counts in the North San Diego and the Mackenzie, roughly speaking, match the dam counts of fish counted by videos. If you make assumptions about harvest rates of the Bennett Dam, and there is no harvest of a Lieber, or no compliant harvest of a Lieber. My staff says, and many of them have years of experience, that this seemed to be a pretty good year. Very good counting conditions, no freshet events that would have thrown everything and reset everything. Our peak counts are in line with what we've seen in recent years, and the data seem to be fairly well behaved for a change. So we expect over the next few months to get these things cleaned up to the point where it can be distributed to the group for review. That's what I got. Questions?
What's going on in the Mackenzie? It's kind of surprising.
Same here.
Not good.
Your hatchery return is down, and the wild return is down. Hatchery return is up, wild return is stable. North San Diego, I think it's about the same story. It's just the Mackenzie. Oh, yeah. Was Middle Fork? Dan, are you still on?
Oh, yeah. No, but he's up.
Okay.
No. We had the same about
Hatchery
about
returns about up. And what about wild fish counts at Fall Creek?
Fall Creek, we're about pretty much in range. We're at 380-something. Cougar, we saw 500 wilds.
So, trust me, for the last 3 days that I've been working on the data, I'm really curious. What's going on with McKenzie?
Well, according to this, 500 at Cougar,
yeah.
That's a third of the wild run.
Right.
So that, I mean, that return.
I'm sorry, you got to add those to this count, though. This is just below dam surveys that I'm talking about. So I guess you could.
No, but your Lieber count was like 1,500.
Oh, that's Lieber count includes the 500 wild fish.
Yeah, which is a third of those fish were Cougar.
We're at the lowest returns on record when you account for fishery harvest changes and all that. I mean, the 90s was bad, but that's when fisheries were really going, and now fisheries are 10% mortality, and we're getting 1,000 fish equivalent. I mean, that's things are grim for the McKenzie.
What changed in that subbasin? What physically did anything physically change? I mean, I know we've got temperature control going on. That's going to warm up the South Fork a bit, but it seems to be responding adequately for the fish returning to Cougar.
Right.
Was there other?
That's kind of surprising that your return was down.
Yeah. Lance, is it just, you know, you said it was both the hatchery and the wild, but is the hatchery more skewed than the wild returns?
What did you say? You were down quite a bit.
Yeah, 4,400 is usually around our 10-year average, and we were at 38, almost 39. Last year we were at 6,000 basically, and the year before 6,800. And the counts at the dam were like this. They didn't, you know, they were real low. I mean, we were wondering that last year and the year before too.
All right, but
it's not really not that low. I mean, based on the average, Kirk just mentioned.
Yeah, but when all the other programs are above the average,
yeah, that's the anomaly. Everything else is
in the wild,
going gangbusters.
Can you go back to that one graph, the long term for McKenzie, Lieber counts?
So the last good year was what, 2004?
I mean, so that increase was kind of basin wide, so that kind of paints a different picture. But if you go back and look at through the 90s, I mean, it was low, and it was low across the board, but those were when fishery mortality, you know, in the lower Willamette stuff was 30-40%. Now it's 10%, and we're at similar escapement levels now, so things are not good.
But I'm just one.
Yeah.
One spot. The runs are contemporaneous, so they all go to the line of falls at the same time, you think. So remember, you got a 3-day-old data set. What is it? 4 days. Got it all together on Saturday. Don't wig out about it. It's not going to change very much. We shouldn't count any more rets. That's the maximum rets we said we had, I'd say. And we did. My crews tell me the ret counts this year are as reliable as they could be. They're done by the same people who've done them the last couple of years, same techniques, same survey reaches, and we were successful at covering all of the survey reaches that are part of the traditional sampling regimen. So
on here, for 2012, you're showing 2,000.
Now it's just a simple 2.5 expansion of the number of reps.
Okay.
The rest are your numbers from Kirk Schroeder's massaging. Lieber counts and red counts and carcass distributions and red distributions. He's got this several page protocol that I'm sure he's discussed with you. He shared it with me, but I'm not comfortable enough to do it, so I just multiply by 2.5. He come up with this relatively speaking similar numbers. His are more defensible, and probably more precise, but they're certainly within 100, 200 fish each other. You might want to worry about this anymore or go on to the next thing just so I can bang through it.
Next thing.
Ian had a pretty good idea.
Pretty good.
I thought it was a great idea when he first brought it up, and then we started to dig into it. All right, work in progress. The idea is that this agency, ODFNW, my agency, went through the exercise of doing some predation work by juvenile or by planted trout on Chinook salmon some years ago, and this is going to loop and loop and loop until you have a, until you guys have a seizure or something.
So keep staring at it while you talk.
What Ian said was, can we just somehow look to see whether there's anywhere that there are hatchery planter trout plants that are obviously of a great deal of risk. I have to use my hands up here, sorry. And what you're seeing looping here, right here, is a map created by one of our guys who is good at this. Yeah, it's a work in progress. So back up. And you need to have a key. And I printed out a few. I didn't realize there'd be so many people. So you have to share them. This describes what he's seeing. And this is more of a hypothesis generating tool right here. So this is going to
share.
Okay, the hydrograph, that's the North Santa Ana, South Santa Ana, Mackenzie, Middle Fork, Willamette. Yeah. These right here, these colored parts of the hydrograph are spawner red densities in reds per kilometer. And their key to that is on their numeric key is on the maps you've got in your hands. Ignore that. We're talking high density, medium density, low density. All this is we're just trying to get a feel for, is there a place here where this is going to bang you on the head and say, this is a risky proposition. The colored dots, big ones here, are hatchery trout plants into reservoirs. Okay, they're into reservoirs, that's Detroit. The clear dots are hatchery trout plants into running water. So clear dots planted on top of high density rearing habitat conceivably poses a risk of predation to emerging fry, if in fact the fry are there at the time that the plant occurs. So if you look at this right here, right about there, that dot appears right here, and just after that, that dot appears right there. And those are mid-season trout plants in the Mackenzie that are happening at about the time we'd expect to see probably quite a few fry emerging, and I'll freeze that right here so we can talk about it. Oh, damn. Sorry. Do it again. It's okay. Okay. So there are problems with that. There's two levels of risk that I'm thinking about right here. One is future risk. And if we ever manage to get production of natural production of reasonable numbers of fry out of the North Santa Ana and the Brighton Bush, then they're coming down into a reservoir as fry that is receiving very, very large numbers of hatchery plant trout. But the key of these right here is this. Each one of these is like 4,000 pounds of planter trout. He's on the I guess there's a risk there, except the reservoir dogs have done some surveys recently, and I got the report right there. They're, the actual detection of a fry in the stomach of a rainbow trout is fairly low. I think they got, in the report, they got two Chinook fry in the stomach of one enormous planter trout, 300 plus milliliters. It was in the same fish. And that was the only fish that had any fry in its stomach. So the actual capture rate might be pretty low. On the other hand, the numbers of fish that are planted is very, very large. So the risk there is there a potential that even low predation rates can translate into an effect size that is worth us worrying about in these situations where we're trying to get recovery above reservoirs and very intensive planting of trout in those reservoirs. What fry would be exposed?
What is the primary food in the stomachs? Only scrubs and the legs?
Daphnia and insects. The main, and I've got the report if you haven't seen it. I brought it with me in case those questions came up. But they're not eating fish. They're not particularly piscivorous. The Olagus just isn't. They'll eat fry. They've done that. But they're mostly appearing as a little bit.
Ecologically, too.
Well, not in a reservoir. The fry are going to be exposed in the reservoir because if they're hanging along the margins, then the planter trout are going to be fine if they're interested in eating it. But then so are sculpin and the pecknose and everything else that's in there. The other risky situation is what's happening down in this reach right here. This dot right here is artifactual because They don't record where they exactly plant. They just say that they scatter plant rainbow trout into that reach from boats that go downstream and let them go. That's a fairly large number over the course of the year, and it does seem to be something that, might be worth a look at, which is why that effort was undertaken back in 2003, 4, and 5, to look at the incidence of Chinook frying the stomachs of those trout. They didn't find very many. They didn't find hardly any at all. It does happen. They do eat fry, but as a good triage sort of thing, and you look at the level of risk that might be posed, I don't even know if it is, it might be posed by these fish, and then look at the other sort of, I call them anthropogenic insults that are occurring in these watersheds. And I'm not sure how important it is.
Just quick, going back to the North Sandia, the one thing to consider, though, is, I mean, we will be looking at outplanting adults in the Brighton Bush and the North Sandia, and we do have stocking going on also in the Brighton Bush.
Right. Yeah.
Up in that area, and it's not only that direct predation, but also we see when we get anglers in there that the big trout are much more appetizing for the angler to catch than the planted trout.
That's a fine point. You brought that up the last time, and I said, this is what I agreed to do, right here.
Yeah.
So the next step that I'd be willing to undertake is to model the temporal changes in emergence timing that we can get based on thermal regime or estimated temperatures in the reaches of interest. And sometime over the next few months, I'd like to take a look at that, because we've got the expertise of Brian Cannon, Kirk Schroeder's crew, that do that to plan their sampling regimen. When they want to go out to the rivers, they want to make sure they're going out to the rivers after emergencies occur, so they keep track of when emergencies will occur in particular sampling locations. And I think I can just import some of that information.
And are you saying if you did this and found some compelling results, that you could change the way the hatchery fish, the timing of which the hatchery fish are planted to avoid interactions?
So you're asking me, if I found out emergence of fry was occurring at a time large numbers of rainbow trout were passed on top of them, could I change the pattern that rainbow trout were planted?
Could you make recommendations to whoever calls those shots?
No. Why? I can't prove that they're actually having risk. All I can say is that the potential for risk is there. So that's where somebody has to step up and either accept the research that's gone on in the past that showed very low predation rates, or fund a pretty elaborate study to repeat that research and come up with answers that you can, for whatever reason, believe.
Well, like one of the things we're seeing at Fall Creek is we're seeing those juvenile chinook coming out of the reservoir of a larger size right now. And one of the theories we're having is that we've reduced that competition by draining out that reservoir. It seems to me when you get into a situation where putting hatchery trout in the reservoir, that might, you know, make that same sort of competitive, you know, performance issue with those chinook.
Okay.
So it's another thing that, you know, might be contributing to this. So there's a lot of factors in this. It's not just that direct mortality.
Well, it's a great point. And so I'll ask Mr. Nimp's representative, Lance, here, because there are RPAs in the biological opinion that ask the action agencies to evaluate effects of the rainbow trout program. Do you have any thoughts on that?
In the new bio, there says RPA?
2008 bio.
Oh. No, I just, well, I hope everybody's aware of the study that was done under the last biop in the McKinsey. I mean, you're reviewing those results, you understand the results, and you realize the limitations of doing any of these predation studies. There's issues there that you can never overcome, really.
Right. But you can take the existing information, you can draw in information from Ziller's work on distribution and persistence of the hatchery trout and their fishing monitoring. And I think you can pretty reasonably conclude that the levels of risk posed by this through predation are low. But that's not experimentally demonstrated until you go in there and you pump many, many, perhaps tens of thousands of stomachs so that you get a fry ingestion rate, conduct an experiment to look at what's called a gastric evacuation rate so that you can expand the number of fry found in the stomachs of a large number of trout over time to the total effect size. To get a total effect size, you also need to know the abundance of the prey item that's in the river. So if you really want to answer how many fry are in the river at a time, how many predators can eat them, at what rate do the predators eat them, so what's the effect size? And I seem to find myself talking to you, Dave, and telling you that's just too hard to do in several instances. And then you go ahead and you find somebody to try it. I guess I've done it. It was a multiple year, hundreds of thousands of dollars, got a pub out of it, go Cam, but it was on a little tiny river. Okay, it was on a little tiny river. It was like the entire watershed was as big as the South Fork Mackenzie. Doing it in four subbasins the size of Rhode Island, as or even just focusing on Mackenzie. That's a bit onerous task.
I mean, to be frank and offer our perspective on this. I mean, as we said before, there's focus on what we do know. We know that large numbers of trout are in these reservoirs. They're being planted. We got a reasonable idea of what their diet is. That's not showing a big problem, but in light of all of the other things going on with these fish, the predation, potential predation on from hatchery trout on juvenile Chinook is the least of our worries in these reservoirs. And when we don't have adequate fish passage through these and they're suffering 50 plus mortality, when you put the predation of these Chinook in light of what they're going to suffer at their next life stage, you know, is it really an issue?
We would probably say no, it's not. It's just when you get things going on in that are, you know, not directly related to the program, but when we hear information about, you know, potentially 50% of the adults in Fall Creek getting poached, you know, that takes out a substantial part of the production, you know, from that system. And I think if we looked at that trout program and maybe modified that so we didn't have anglers up there tempted to do this, you know, I just kind of wonder as we go towards, you know, recovering these species, do we want to have the same type of really, you know, high density trout program going on with harassment and poaching and all these other factors, not direct mortality? Because it's definitely going to limit what we're going to see up there when you get that kind of a poaching model. And that's going to be hard to enforce.
Yeah, and in my mind, that's a whole another issue on if poaching's a real concern. You know, and down in my neck of the woods on the Umpqua, where poaching's a concern on spring Chinook and they're very low levels, they shut down fishing entirely. So if you see anybody up there, you know what their intent is. And that's an entirely different conversation, I think, than the trout stocking.
It's related to where the trout stocking.
Bear in mind that there's a great deal of interest in the predation issue in general in the reservoirs, okay? And just like this. So that's going forward. The existing sampling right now, it's happening, Fred Monzik's crews, big reports, lots of fish that are getting checked. That's going on into the future. There will be directed monitoring of predation rates on fry
from all species,
yeah, including rainbow trout, brown bullhead, crappie, pumpkin seed, whatever else are eating.
On that old Mackenzie report, didn't that estimate an 8 to 10% loss?
The effect size?
I'm just thinking of what we're seeing on the Mackenzie right now with those numbers down. I mean, 8 to 10%.
That's not what I recall. This was years ago, and it was while I was trying to catch up on what's been going on in the Willamette. But I didn't think it was that high. I thought it was more in line with what I was seeing in southwestern Washington. So an effect size, maximum effect size was like 3 or 4%. And that was that's kind of the worst possible scenario. You know, you can take all of the data you've got, you put boundaries on it, and you say the worst possible scenario is that there's a few percent effect size. And then you make a decision, is that worth a policy? Or is that something you just ignore in the background?
Well, the other thing is the recent, and Kurt knows this better than I do, the recent changes to hatchery trout stocking above Lieber is drastically reduced compared to when that study occurred. Okay. Is that right?
I believe so, yeah.
So that has changed. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a concern at Foster with the rainbow trout and the juvenile winter steelhead coming through that system? Because I think there were some previous studies that found it kind of a similar impact.
Yeah, there was some studies done on the old biop on that, and it was kind of that similar thing where as long as we have marked trout going into the reservoir with bread, that was the main issue.
Okay.
And when you looked at catch in the fishery of wild steelhead versus hatchery trout, it was predominantly hatchery trout. And so we said, you know, sure, you're catching some fish, but it's relatively minor. I can't remember the results of that. You have to go back and look at it.
And then with the conversation about disease earlier, is that a concern with these hatchery trout releases?
By the time we put them out, they're usually pretty clean. Or, you know, the cold-wise these issues, they're usually when they're put in the number. By the time they get to be legal, they're in good shape.
Well, thanks for producing this, Cameron. It's fascinating. I don't think at this point you need to pursue any further temporal analysis type of work you were referring to.
I have to, for another reason, we provided some samples of eggs to a researcher up in Washington who's very interested in looking at patterns of variation in early incubation and development of the embryo, and that relates to the thermal regime of this eggs and the gravel experience, and so I'm going to be digging into the data anyway, just because it could relate strongly to the decisions on whether a fish stays or goes as a fry or as a smoke.
Well, and maybe that threshold length, you know, where predation risk goes down substantially, because those fish, they're interacting all summer long,
yep.
You know. But is there, at what point are Chinook kind of out of the...
Technically, it's about 44% of the body size of the predator, a rainbow trout or micus, and 50% for a cutthroat. But the preferred size range is on the order of 30 millimeters. That's the preferred size for a rainbow trout to eat a fry, because they can chase them down easily, get them down easily, right. Cape size as well. And those fish very quickly grow out of that size range. And remember, all of these fish are coexisting with native predators. Their entire lives, every time they're out of the gravel, they're going to be experiencing interactions, if you will, between cutthroat and sculpin. Sculpin are voracious predators on the fry. So they get experience. My old boss, the late Howard Fuss, had a nice project where it demonstrated that there's kind of a learning curve for hatchery trout. It takes about 10 days for them to actually decide a fry is edible, that they can eat it, 10 days. And there's a lot of fishing going on top of those fish at the same time. So take Jeff Ziller's work that shows kind of the extraction rate of planter trout over the time that they're in the river and susceptible to angling pressure. They're pretty much gone for each given plant before they really have a chance to learn that fry are good. And it's... there's a lot of arguments to keep it on the back burner, to be thinking about it, but there's also a lot of arguments that it doesn't seem to be the highest risk that these creatures face. That's the story of state.
Are you going to summarize that, or?
It's in the annual report.
Okay. Helpful.
Definitely. Thank you for putting that together.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Do you know what the minnow populations are in the reservoirs?
Absolutely no idea. God, we've been having discussions back and forth.
There's a lot of texture.
How do you get an idea of a predator population, multiple ages?
Yeah.
Was that mark release in a reservoir like Lookout? Any ideas? We'd love to have an approach for it, but I don't know.
Because there are definitely high-end predators on the fry.
Yeah. Those the bullhead and the pike minnow are the ones that will find most of the fry.
Hey,
all
right. Thank you, Cameron, for your sharing that information with us. Any questions for Cam before we move on to our final agenda topic? I put on the agenda a roundtable discussion, and we can keep this relatively brief, but we've had discussions in the past on numerous occasions about the out planning, trapping, handling protocols, and they've been written up in various documents. In fact, they exist in the draft HGMPs, a document that Ian's been working on for a while that Willamette, the WFOP, that will have a lengthy section on trapping, out planning protocols, handling, that type of thing. And most of this is not new science. I mean, we've got, in fact, each fish facility design document, they have, you know, relatively strict guidelines for handling and capacity of fish and things like that. So the stuff's out there. But, you know, we've talked about standardizing this across all the facilities, and I'm not sure that we're quite there yet. And there's a number of reasons that happens. It has to do with staffing, has to do with money, has to do with truck availability. There's lots of factors that play into this. So we wanted to have just maybe, I wanted to pick some brains here and have a roundtable discussion of what we thought would be a good starting point to try to standardize these protocols and and we're kind of taking this information. We want to drill down and ultimately focus at least next year to Dexter Fish Facility. You know, we've been talking about this for probably at least a year. The idea about, and I don't know if Dan's still on the phone, but
nobody's on the phone.
Yeah, okay. So a lot of fish come into the tail race and they stack up, and Dan and his staff don't open that facility till, what is it, generally about mid-June, I think, is when he first opens that facility.
And by then, couple of years, I think we're getting a few in May.
And by then, there are potentially hundreds and hundreds of fish that are stacked up or have been stacked up in that tail race. So there have been discussions about, well, we should outplant them early, and even some of the core folks, Greg Taylor and others, have actually done some of that work in the past. Anyways, we'd like to repeat some of those efforts and actually have some RM&E wrapped around that. And Chris Caudill from U of I was going to put a proposal together last spring, but by the time we actually asked him to do it, you know, we were probably close to May anyway, so we just ran out of time. And we, amongst ourselves at the Corps, said, well, let's make sure we get it done first this spring. We've still got plenty of time to develop a proposal. But I wanted it, and Ian's got some thoughts on this too, but we wanted to get some thoughts from you folks, you know, just what would be some, in an ideal world, how would we want to outplant fish, specifically thinking about the Dexter facility, and ultimately thinking that we want to apply this to all of our facilities, so that we have a standardized protocol.
So you're thinking about what happens on the hatchery grounds, or you're thinking about the whole operation?
You're done with this.
Is one of the things
we're talking about the entire operation.
Well, low hanging fruit. You got to have a place to put them that you can get them to. I mean, outplanting locations, good quality places where
yep.
you can put fish with nice holding pools.
That's a great question.
Just to clarify, the thought on this I had was that it's going to be how we're going to operate the trapping facility itself, how we're going to actually get those fish on a truck, how we would move that truck up there and deliver those fish, not necessarily the site itself, but all of the trapping, handling, transport, release type protocols.
Okay.
So, you know, what I was thinking is kind of what we should be looking at here for the bigger items, so trap opening date. You know, one of the questions that came up, and this stemmed from a review and response the Corps received from an SOP on cougar trap operations. You know, when I was looking at these responses, you know, some of these responses said, you know, you should move a fish when you get two of them in there. Well, let's try to standardize this stuff amongst the facilities, knowing we are going to have some differences, you know, staffing-wise, truck-wise, travel distance-wise. Some of these outplanting sites are a good distance away from these trapping facilities. But point being, I just thought we should have a good conversation on trying to standardize at least some of these general areas of consideration for these traps. So in other words, when do you open the facility? Should you move a fish when you have one in there? Or what's the trigger to move a fish? How long does it need to stay in there? And I know there's some protocol that has been established in the past, but what I wanted to do was focus on getting a generalized protocol developed for the WFOP and then work through the specifics of each facility. And as these new facilities like Minto come online, we're going to live and learn with that. There's going to be specifics for that. We have Foster coming down the line, also Dexter. But we also have Cougar that's up and running right now. We have Fall Creek up and running right now. And as Dave said, we want to do some RM&E at Dexter this year. So I guess, you know, focusing on Dexter, but don't forget the bigger picture of, you know, general protocols for all these facilities. You know, one thing is just for, you know, research purposes also, if we can operate these somewhat in a similar manner, we can do some more of an apples-to-apples comparison, at least within the facility from year to year, but maybe between different facilities on some of these protocols to see if we can actually modify these and inform us on how to manage these in the future. But just to get it out on the table, just the general, you know, categories of things we should be talking about here. You know, trap dates, holding times, densities. We do have some density criteria. You know, things like that. It's just not clear to me. You know, we do get operations plans, but it's not clear to me, you know, why we have differences in some of these facilities. And some of it just doesn't make sense. Some of it does because it's based on the
unit. I think one thing you're looking at, too, is like I'm comparing my facility to South San Diego, Dexter. They got dams. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're going to get this pile of fish at certain times the way the dams operate. Brett has told me before that you know, certain spill gates are open. He may get flooded with fish or not. I think the same thing's true with Dexter. My fish just come in when they get there.
I think you're off the hook.
Yeah. So and we just move, matching with Cougar's trap, we just move fish as they get them. Now, if they get two or three, they're moving them. We're not. We're waiting till, you know, a couple dozen at least, and then we'll move fish up.
Here, everybody's napping. Get the lights on. Let's go.
Yeah. So, you know, we go into our trap weekly, if not two times a week, if not three times a week, depending on the loads of fish that come into our trap. Mm-hmm. So it's all a visual for us, you know. And sometimes staffing is an issue, you know.
Right.
You know, we just don't have any. Yeah, we don't have anybody here for the 4 days. We got vacation. We got guy on this 4 day. We've got. We better wait till Monday, and for me, I try to do as much as I can on a Friday, so we don't hit this weekend of, you know. I mean, we had 900 fish come into our trap overnight one time. You know, that's a shock.
Right.
When you get out there. You know,
well,
so.
The Corps has been talking, even at Cougar, putting some sort of an automated system in there to tell us when we have fish coming in, so we don't have staff driving all the way up there to look and say,
yeah,
it's empty.
Sounds like
so it's yeah, we are moving forward with that. So.
I thought that was my future job, though. Was
just move up
early. I want that job. Wait a second.
Isn't the retirement queue first?
Yeah.
You know, I think it's hard to put it in a box, though. I mean, because, you know, like, mm-hmm. Like you said, the facilities are so different, and, you know, the hauling times are different. The staffing's different. Like, I know, like, Dexter, trying to focus on Dexter, a huge problem for them is the fact that they, the lack of trucks. And, you know, if they've got steelhead, you know, you've also got all these mitigation fish, you know, that you have to work too. You know, you got summer steelhead that you have to, you know, that like at Foster and Dexter, you don't have holding ponds to put those fish into. They have to go onto a truck. So if you're hauling brood and you only have one truck,
right,
what do you do with the outplant fish? Well, do you put them back and then you handle those outplant fish twice? And I think that's one thing, you know, another...
These are the types of things we really need to avoid.
Yeah, the puzzle that, you know, is that I notice, like, the fish, like the Chinook we recycle, those fish are, don't look as good as the fish, new fish. I mean, you know, that handling does have an effect. And then, no offense to research, but, I mean, how much are you going to handle these fish?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, our research fish now are getting the most handling of all these fish now.
Yeah.
And then if you put them at a poor outplant site, or if the pipe... You know, I know, like, we're struggling with some outplants at, like, Riverbend. It's not the best situation, the pipe that's there. I mean, in a floppy hose wouldn't be any better, but Ian knows that, you know, even though it's well above the high water mark, you can't just take a cat in there put some nice riprap in there and backfill it and have a nice gradient slope. It goes, those fish get jettisoned into the river, you know, And, you know, I mean, there's just things like that you run into, and it's different, you know, that, you know, bird doesn't have, or Willamette doesn't have, or Minto doesn't have, you know. So I think those triggers you're talking about are going to be different for different facilities, but that's just my two cents. But, you know, it's hard to...
But I think, Ian, there have to be some sort of standardization, mm-hmm. some sort. And again, two things is that we need to look at... First is a look at the current condition of the facilities. Okay, that's one. And then also looking is at where are we going to be 6-7 years from now, where we have, you know, basically most of those facilities will be fully complete. I'm talking about Minto, I'm talking about Foster, I'm talking about Dexter. So where some sort of a protocol, not only, you know, on transportation, but across the board can be reached, okay, and it will be perhaps pretty common, okay? There will be a high degree of commonality among all of those facilities. I think right now that is a bit hard to absorb anyway because of all the uncertainties. And again, looking at, I think is the good thing is, you know, going back to the SCAP group that we had, I mean, there was a consensus on the amount of fish that needed to be put on those tanks, whether it was 1,000 gallons or 2,000 gallons. So I think that was an achievement, okay? And one thing on that one is that we need to push hard on that and making that possible, if nothing else, okay? At least that is something that everyone agreed upon, okay, to do it. And the other one is everyone says in here, each facility is unique. In a sense, you know, you got McKenzie, I mean, it's pretty much the fish come in, you are there, okay? Foster, again, right now it's... Also, even though it takes a lot of manpower, the beauty of the whole thing is that the facility is close to Foster, okay? And so they have been able to manage that through the years. When we look at Willamette, totally different. totally different, where basically you need pretty much the whole manpower of the facility to go and operate the facility on every time that they go sorting. So if we're trying to increase the frequency that those fish get moved or handled, I mean, that is a component that we have to look at first in order for us to make that happen. The other thing is also there is another one, and that is not just the fact of moving the fish or doing the handling at the facility. It goes back to the statement that Cam made at the beginning, and that is looking at the site where those fish are going to go. One thing is I think we know, and there have been some proposals presented in the past and some discussion, and I think it kind of goes in a circle, and that is we, and correct me on this if I'm wrong, but I don't think right now we are certain whether or not it is the best thing to take those fish, to plant those fish early from the beginning of the time that they're coming into the trap, or whether it would be better to keep those fish in a rearing pond and then take them there later on, you know, when the temperatures come down or things like that. That was an idea presented some time ago. I mean, looking at comparing the high mortality that we were getting from fish being put in those systems, you know, early.
That's a different story.
But there is a lot of things in there that we need to consider. But again, yes. Going back to the logistic of some of those facilities, I think is one thing from my point of view is looking at, we already know that, you know, we have worked, I think, on the density. You know, how, you know, what the load should be on those trucks. I think that we can work on that and standardize that across the facilities. I think that is a doable one. The other one, when it gets the manpower, like such as Dexter. Dexter. If we're going to operate that facility, it started, you know, in May or whatever, we need to have that manpower. Not only the manpower, but also we need to have the trucks to do it.
So that's, I think, the point you're getting at, Manny, is I think the limitations on this are something we have to highlight.
Yes.
You know, so we get into these major kind of areas of discussion. Each one of these facilities is going to have different limitations based on what we're talking about. And in some cases, I know that we discussed this last year with Dexter, is that the Corps has a crew that could come in a couple times a week potentially and help out at Dexter. You know, to have more frequent transport of fish. So there's certain situations where you could probably address those concerns. And the other thing, too, is that I don't want to wait until, say, Fall Creek is rebuilt. You know, I want to look at what we could do differently at Fall Creek right now, because there's things we could be doing differently at these facilities as they exist now. So, and the other thing, too, is as these new facilities like Minto come online, you know, not to say we're completely shifting what our goals are with you know, what we're doing in these basins, but since we have a facility that's built to, you know, to reduce the stress and handling in these fish, we should be looking at the protocol real closely and make sure that matches with the facility that's being built.
Well, I think Manny does bring up a good point, and Minto is a great example. We don't yet know. It's hard, I think, to say what is the ideal outplanting protocol when we don't know whether it's better to hold those fish or to outplant them as we come in.
So I didn't know we were still discussing that one.
I'm sorry?
I didn't think that was still on the table, actually. I apologize for that, because I thought we had already kind of gotten through that, thinking that, you know, if we're supposed to be developing a fish adapted to that ecosystem, that's one of the biop goals.
And that's why we're matching.
Be shooting ourselves in the foot, and I think, by restricting that, you know, adaptation in the wild by holding them that long. But I apologize, I didn't think that was still actually on the table.
But if you're putting them into inhospitable areas like in the Middle Fork, where you're going to lose 95% of those early fish, you're essentially eliminating that component. So it's
hearing
one of
on that,
that you have to.
But you have to. I just think, you know, you got to challenge some of those fish to be survivors and bring them back up there, and that's how you naturalize the stock.
Piece of this is getting back to answer your question is, you know, we have these genetic samples. We have years, and you know, there's a room full of them. We've been collecting.
Probably here.
Call my
anyway,
office.
Yeah. It'd be nice to know if those fish are contributing. Mm-hmm. We could know right now if you analyze the data. Yeah. We have the answer. But we don't.
That's in the homes.
Okay, yeah, but I mean, so until you answer that question, you might as well, I mean, there's a possibility you could put them in my front yard and get as many fry out of them. Seriously,
yeah, but
you know what I'm saying.
Well, I know what you're saying.
You know, or are those fish coming from below Foster?
Right, but just because we have a question about that, I don't think we should...
Right. But what I'm saying is, you know, if you're going to put a lot of money, a lot of effort, a lot of time, if you can answer that question, answer the question. You know, and maybe you could say, hey, this isn't it.
Maybe we need
to work on something else. I mean, we're wasting a lot of money here. I mean, that's kind of, you know what I mean? It's like, that's the main question. And if you can answer it, why not put your energy towards that?
I think there's a good point. I think it may be, in the long term, it may be the wise choice to put those fish through that selective pressure of being placed in inhospitable water, as it may be. But that's something that deserves some long thought and maybe some good research. Are you going to drive that population into the ground as you're at the same time that you're trying to found a new population?
I just wonder, that's a very fine line to walk. I mean, is that a practice that's common in other basins to hold the stringers, hold them, and then release them?
Why? I didn't realize that had been taken off the table.
Maybe it isn't, and I just didn't know.
I mean, all the discussions that I recall is we've left that open as a short-term thing. You know,
to
we may need to do that to boost the population, but over the long term, I think all of us are in agreement that we don't want to do that year after year after year.
Well, one of the
we
things
know that, that that's not what's going to meet our goals of a naturally self-sustaining populations.
As I understand it, one of Jim Peterson's ideas for talking about pre-spawning mortality modeling efforts in this basin includes a kind of adaptive management approach to that. If you've got a situation where you could predict with some reasonable certainty that you'd be dumping a group of fish into a buoy base, then you'd have to take a different management action and perhaps hold those fish in more ideal circumstances in a hatchery and outplant them later. But if you've got a weather forecast or near-term climate idea, the climate's going to be like in those particular years, you would do something different. You'd outplant them in time for them to experience the natural environment. I think that's the focus of the research he's proposed already, is to figure out, well, what do you do under the different circumstances associated with environmental variation in a basin? Well, basin to basin and year to year.
And it's kind of what we've done at Fall Creek, and we founded that with a hatchery stock. That's now a wild returning stock, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we get a lower pre-spawn mortality there than we do above in the North Fork, Middle Fork area. Correct?
Correct, but I mean, I have
in similar water temperature conditions.
And those fish are moved as soon as they come in.
Right, and then I think basin-wide, ESU-wide, the lowest pre-spawn mortality estimates we have are Mackenzie above Lever and Clackamas, which are, again, they have the highest percentage of naturally produced fish.
You also have the best habitats.
Yeah.
That's a huge difference.
Yeah, you know, I get concerned when I hear folks talk about the, you know, Middle Fork Willamette, the habitat upstream being inhospitable. Before those dams were there, these spring chinook ascended that river and kept going and went to where they wanted to go and hung out for months to spawn. So why is that now inhospitable? Granted, there's reservoirs. They're a serious issue. And maybe a lot of that prime habitat is now underneath those reservoirs. But still, seems to me that if we reduce that, and I'm sort of thinking back to Dexter, but if we reduce that pressure, that density pressure of those things sitting in that tail race, which is, you know, in the absence of doing that, you're basically letting these things just cook, and you're taking these things that are fish that are almost dead, and then you go, God, look at they died up there. It doesn't matter. And then your only option really then is to take them into Willamette Hatchery and inject the living daylights out of them and then take them up a week before they're ready to spawn. But that is not the way we're going to conduct business in the future. I mean, we're not going to be able to operate that way anymore. And so this idea about having some R&E efforts looking at different types of experiments, I mean, we're talking about that right now. You know, what would happen if you did certain treatments? But, you know, the run comes in. It comes in a certain time. It's been doing this year after year. Granted, it moves a little bit, but you've got this nice shape where there's you know, the beginning, the peak, and then it tails off. Those fish should be moved out, you know, in accordance with how they come into that facility, and they shouldn't be allowed to sit there for weeks and weeks and weeks without being moved. And so that's what we're proposing. We're saying let's do this and conduct an experiment around it and see what shakes out. But you know, I know it sounds horrible, but I think Ian's right. At the end of the day, we need to move these fish when they come in, and you know, maybe the stronger ones will ultimately survive, and there won't be very many. But and then over time, we're going to improve downstream passage, and you know, and these things are going to take time. But we're building these state-of-the-art multi-million-dollar fish facilities, and we're not building these so that we can continue to operate as we have. So we really need to think about this. And Minto's a perfect example. It's going to be online next spring. We have to have a plan for how we're going to be operating that facility. So we're just trying to stimulate the conversation here.
There's no doubt that moving the fish out of Dexter as soon as you can is beneficial. I mean, just look at the percent mortality of the adults when they're being held. Willamette is by far higher than anywhere else. And it's not because of the pond itself. It's because of the conditions that those fish are being held below Dexter, the handling of Dexter, in the adult pond, you know, everything else when you put it all together. So you're right, but whether then you put them directly into the habitat that may or may not be conducive to them surviving, that's another decision that you need to make. Or whether you take them to a hatchery with a clean water supply, where you take away the pathogens, the issues that we normally have with Dexter, that's another thing to take care of. But, you know, I mean, South San Yam, the fish hold extremely well, and they're in their reservoir. So what's the difference? Temperature, primarily. He has the ability to control temperature. So his temperature stays low. We can't do that at Dexter.
Not only that, but you got the temperature, you have also the distance. It's just there. It takes you, maybe 10 minutes to move it from point A to point B.
Half hour.
But again, going back to your, I think this is maybe that's an approach that we probably should take in on an experimental basis. But again, it comes back to the manpower. Okay, this is some of the things that we have been talking about. Because if it is the expectation of the court for us to move on, you know, with the number of people that we have at Willamette, I can tell you there's no way we can do it. There's no way we can do it. But again, I mean, let's try it. I mean, I think is, you know, I like to let's look for options, okay, that will make things better. Again, it's one thing that I look at is, yes, we have right now, we feel pretty comfortable with the densities in the tanks, you know, the transfer tanks. Now let's look at now the handling. But the bottom line is whether those fish come into the trap or whether those fish are down below and they decide not to come to the trap. I mean, those are two different, because the bottom line is that the environment is impacting those fish and is stressing those fish. So it would be great if we can find, if the answer is if we take those fish early, that those fish will do better. Great. I mean, that's part of the game. But like I mentioned to you, I think we need to have some sort of a subgroup, okay, where we can sit down. I want to have the manager in there. I want to have the bios and look at the different strategies and come up with a plan and have something set up, okay? I mean, time is running fast. I mean, basically, it's almost November, and bottom line is that we got to have people, we got to have trucks, all of that.
Manny, we will have a meeting in November with a task, with a work group, subgroup, whatever you want to call them, of the appropriate people, including Dan, obviously. We want to work through some of these Dexter issues. And we totally understand that your staff currently cannot currently do what we might want you to do. You don't have the trucks, you don't have the human beings, but we do have a commitment from the Corps that they'll be able to send staff, Greg Taylor and his crew, with a truck and people and to help out. So we're not going to ask you guys to do something that's not possible to do. But we will have some meetings very shortly, and we'll get this thing moving forward.
Could you work with U of I? Do you think they did that?
And that's then, what we're gonna
do. Okay, their radio tag a percentage each month or something.
Ultimately, who's going to end up developing this proposal is going to be U of I. With all of our assistance, really.
Is that information? I know they did a lot of tagging at our facility this year. Is that information going to be coming out?
I hope so. Yeah, I think Wertheimer is in charge of that. But yes, all of that will come out.
That'd be interesting.
It's good stuff.
Cool. Yeah, it's kind of real time.
Yep. Yeah. So anyways, that's our plan. That's our thoughts.
I would strongly suggest that you look into using Acquiesce 20E. from when they're not selling fish or giving away to their wives or anything else, because I don't know if you've ever been at Dexter when they're selling fish.
Yes.
It's brutal.
It's not pretty.
Well, that's one of the differences between Fall and Dexter. Fall Creek, we use that. Dexter, we don't.
It's a huge difference right from the beginning.
Yep.
Well, and just the numbers of fish is way different.
Yeah.
Well, that's one thing we did do this year, though, is at Fall Creek, we're starting to move all of the native fish, and this year we had a monster return of suckers. So we had some loads at Fall Creek that were pushing the limits because we were doing that. So that's one thing that I need to talk to that staff about as well, because I know there was some direction given by ODF&W to move all resident fish upstream. Well, the Fall Creek drawdown, it appears we evacuated the suckers, and they wanted to come back up this fall, so we got thousands and thousands of suckers back at that facility.
Right.
That
currently is going into the design of that facility. To move resident fish.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if it's an artifact of what how we operate, that maybe we do need to go and look at that for sure. But something to talk about.
In the first year that Chris Cadill was performing his mortality studies, he did have staggered outplanting, and that report should be out. I haven't reviewed it as carefully as I should, but was there any indication that there is a signal between time of outplanting and pre-spawning mortality? And one of the issues that he and I have discussed is that the last couple of years our pre-spawning mortality rates have been relatively low, so it's really hard to find a signal. But what was in that first report? I don't even remember if there was any indication at all that there was a significant.
So over the years, they've done that early outplanting, and years where it's low pre-spawn mortality, those early outplants do good. When it's a year of high pre-spawn mortality, all those early fish are gone. They're dead. So just flip a coin whether they're going to work or not.
Can you match them to water years? I think you probably do.
Yeah.
So you know, for example, if you have a heavy snow year and an early spring with a lot of water, then you're probably pretty safe putting those fish out. In a year where you don't, it may be beneficial to hold those fish and then release them later.
I mean, how much do we want to play Mother Nature on this? I mean, because their run timing is put out like this for ecological reasons for hedge bedding. And if we want to just hold these other fish back and put them all in that late basket, I don't know why.
In February, March, April, you know what your water year looks
right.
like. So if it's a good water year, you know, then you know that your likelihood of having lower pre-spawn mortality is probably better than, you know, your 2001 or whatever the year where it was dry, and you know things are going to be absolutely grim.
Maybe it's not as black and white as that. Maybe what it ends up being is if you know you're going to have an abysmal water year, if you know you're going to have zero snowpack, and you can predict with high certainty that any outplanting is going to be associated with the almost instantaneous mortality of every fish you have all up there, no matter what else you do, you don't do that under circumstances where you're trying to recover the species.
Because some selective pressures are so intense that they extinguish the population, which is what we'd like to avoid, right?
So maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. You do make a real decision to allow challenges to occur for those fish under circumstances where they're survivable.
What do we have to lose in the Middle Fork right now? We only have 50 fish back.
52.
So it
fish
seems
back.
Like.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the crux of the matter at Dexter. Is there's two camps. One camp is we have 50 fish year after year. We've been outplanting thousands year after year. Current conditions aren't working for these fish. So what's the point of doing anything different? The other camp is, let's try some things differently because we can. And so in my mind, it's trying to figure out where's the compromise there.
Yeah.
There's things that we can do because we can do it with more resources, and why not try it? And in some years, it's going to be a benefit. In other years, you're not going to get anything out of it, but at least you're trying to do something. So,
well,
I mean, that's the way I see it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if we sort of subscribe to the first theory you mentioned about we've been doing this for years, we've been getting squat back. Well, if I was the Corps and I was managing money, I'd say, so why are we building a $15 million facility?
Because the understanding is improved downstream passage will bring in more.
Right, but if we're hearing that, I mean, that's the
one. Assuming we get.
To reiterate what Dave said earlier, is the messaging that shouldn't be going out is the habitat up there is so crappy we wouldn't be able to get any production, because that would cause some major hesitancy moving forward with anything. If, you know.
Oh, it absolutely will.
So it's, you know, if that's the case, I think Lance is on board with that. We need to figure out what's going on, if we can do things differently. Or, I mean, if it's the case we can't support any fish up there, it'd be nice to know that.
One thing I think is interesting, just it's not Dexter, but just with Foster, it might be something to kind of compare it to, but like, say, the winter steel population, they're, you know, you're moving them up as they come, low numbers, in optimal time, you know, conditions, the water temperatures are low, and we've done nothing but maintain that population since, I mean, you can look at the crab, the chart, once the dams went in, 2 years after the dams went in, the numbers were still high, and then it crashed. And it stayed right here between 1,000 and 200 fish.
That's
for since 1973, you know. And so, you know, that's, I don't know, I mean, what else could you do there? You know, we
right here.
Yeah, you know, I mean, yeah, you know, maybe it's because they don't have access, like you said, to the habitat that they did, you know, used to thrive in. I don't know. Right. I mean, there's just questions to be answered, you know.
Definitely. That's a good point. Question?
If I could just interject, I'm just really heartened to hear this discussion going on. I think it's really healthy, and I think Ian brought up some great points. Everyone did. In terms of genetics, I don't know how many of you are aware of what's going on with the state of Idaho and how they're spearheading the whole SNPs implementation program. So they were just awarded a huge grant by the Pacific Salmon Marine Recovery Board start up a big coast-wide open access real-time database similar to Patagas or Coated Wire Tag Program, but for SNPs genetics, not the GAPS program. This is going to be bigger and well-funded and well-maintained, and they have developed the SNPs markers to the point now for both steelhead and chinook to the point, and they're working on coho, and they have sockeye. I think it is really coming online as a viable option for just the question you said, the fish above the dam, the fish below the dam, hatchery versus wild. With the parental-based tagging now, you know, 100% mark of every hatchery fish, and the price is coming down to like $17 a sample. Mm-hmm. So it's becoming price competitive, non-lethal sampling, so you can sample your brood stock, and in about 5 hours' time, you can tell if it was hatchery or wild version. This is something to keep in mind. Also, what they have done, Sean Narum's lab has done landscape genetics. Just the points you made, Ian, they've really been targeting not just neutral genes, but what about things that are germane to selection and survival? And so they've mapped, I don't know, several hundred genes for thermal resistance and resistance to multiple diseases, C. shasta being only one of them. And so if you think there has been a bottleneck your populations have gone through, you might want to scan your broodstock and see how they're checking out with, because these are all factors that would influence pre-spawn mortality. So, and that's it.
Points.
You want to say anything to that point?
We're moving in that direction, and I have made some headway there. Last year, I did some work and looked at all the GAPS markers and hatchery and wild populations in the lab, as well as four other markers described by Tom Terry that are immune. We're not using SNPs, so this is working on Michael's lab. So.
Right. But I think, and I again, I have to be careful to not speak too loudly for BPA, but we are fully funding the state of Idaho. They're at 100% implementation now. Mm-hmm. So even the tribes have bought on. They have no problems with the parentage-based tagging because it's just mom and dad that you sample. And the SNPs, they're so automated and they're qualitative. It's not a matter of judgment. So standardization between labs isn't really an issue.
No, I appreciate that.
And when I'm
and how many are they using? Is that 60 markers or what?
96. So you do a 96 SNPs.
I guess that's a frightening number for me. But
it's,
that's 96 PCRs. But it's multiplexing.
Well, not just multiplex. You use one of those adult IBI prisms that it's a little chip that has, put 96 samples here and you have 96 different mixes, and it, 3 hours and you, on the screen you see the green, red, or yellow dot. And
yeah.
So the bottom line is BPA is bankrolling a lot of this, and in all fairness, when we have backed implementation like the GAPS program, we gave funding to all the states to achieve implementation. So California is, now that this funding has come through, California's on board, Alaska's hopping on, the Canadians, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington now. Washington is gearing up. They're going to go for it.
Well, I mean, that's a technology choice, and we actually very seriously considered that in conversations with poor folks about using SNPs for these projects, but for a number of reasons. But I agree with most everything you've said there, and I think there's a lot of potential and a lot of questions can be answered for monitoring and both monitoring and hypothesis-based research.
And there's an opportunity, of course, to do a parallel comparative study using SNPs and dendrites. I let them say you're already using. We've got archive
specimens. Yeah, Idaho did that. They used 11 years worth of archive samples. I can show you.
There are a lot of those SNPs versus microsatellite studies out there. We actually considered doing another, but I thought it was sort of done.
But for the first time, for the steelhead coming up to the Snake River, you know, the water is so murky, so high, they've never been able to get spawning estimates. And at Lower Granite Dam, it was guesswork with wild fish. So now with the SNPs, I mean, microsats couldn't resolve the upper Snake Basin. With SNPs now, they have it down to the watershed. And certainly the 10 reporting groups pop right out. So for the first time now, they actually got estimates of wild run compositions and set their in-season limits for the terminal fisheries, which is pretty exciting. But like I say, as if it becomes standardized, I'm sure that money will be provided to the states to help transition to the technology. So we've already done that with Idaho, and we're helping NOAA do that. Yeah. So.
And I certainly see much more potential to use SNPs for gene length information. It's hard to get a good microsatellite there. Gene means something.
Any last thoughts from the group?
Well, related to that, so long-term pedigree analysis is what we want for all of these reintroduction areas. Is there potential funding, BPA funding, to help along this, help these pedigree analysis?
Well, that's for the state of Idaho. We're funding 100%.
That would work for the Willamette. Yeah, that'd be enough.
Yeah.
And maybe we could do the SNPs.
Well,
one SNP at a time.
Yeah.
One SNP at a time. I mean, no. I mean, we bought them the sequencers and the analyzer. We bought them the software and the hardware to do the analysis, and they're doing real time. And
that sounds fantastic. Bread up there right now at Foster.
Well, the neat thing is it's just that it's not lethal. So, you know, you can just literally a mucus sample from the fish, and then it's a 30-minute extraction. It's kind of like the old Kleenex extraction, but with no phenol or anything nasty. You load it in, and in 3 hours, it is really a whole new technology, because I did the microsats too, and it's very labor intensive, and this is so much faster and so much more automated and so less ambiguous, which is the nice thing.
But transferability among lab systems
is huge. Having said that, BPA is broke this year. And you've all heard that because of the collapsed prices, because of the gas glut in the electric generation business. But this was a new push, so I thought I would put that on the table.
Just ask, right now we've got the pedigree samples going on, and are they continuing at Cougar? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and then we're going to be doing it at South Sanium at Foster for spring chinook and steelhead?
depends. We'll have to be supported by extra staff if we're going to do the DNA sampling in. Griffin, Bob want pit tagging on every steelhead going up there too because of the kelp issue.
Right.
Somebody's got to come up with staff time. We don't have it. I can't just.
So we have archived samples for spring Chinook, not at all the case for steelhead.
Is staff time the bottleneck, or if we threw some money away, could you obtain staff?
It makes more sense for the money to go to the hatchery for them to obtain staff.
Perfect.
Because it's a very long, drawn-out process to take a sample from every single fish that comes in over a eight-month period. If I did it, I would have to hire somebody to do that, and it just doesn't make any sense. They're on station at the hatchery now.
Just wondering, with management looking down the years on moving steelhead above these projects, we know we get a decent amount of summer steelhead wild production going on, and just want to make sure that the genes are brought upstream in the right pair of genes. So.
If that's the right place to put those genes.
Yeah, if they're from there in the first place.
If that doesn't.
We've been taking a representative, 50 to 100 fish sample for the last 3 years.
But that's just not going to work for the pedigree.
Right, yeah, it's not 100%.
Yeah. And if you've had PFAS values of...
17% above there with all unclad fish going up there.
For steelhead?
No, I'm sorry. Sure.
But you don't know if some of the unclipped fish were hatchery fish that spawned below?
All right.
They could be a
well, that's so. The next... Mark's next focus is going to be any fish that noses up to the Foster Dam. Yeah.
But how old of archive samples do we have before the really possible integration started to happen? I mean, do we have samples? We don't have samples before the dams are in there,
no.
Unless you can get DNA off of a taxidermy now. Or scale samples, the ODFW scale samples. You can.
We may have some scale samples.
You can easily do that.
Address that.
But it's...
Any thoughts before we close?
It's a good conversation.
Yeah, no, it was great, and thank you all. And I'm certain you thank me for having the meeting down here.
Thank you.
Because driving is not fun.
Is it going to be here from now on?
Yeah. It's going to be here again sometime in the future.
We from Corvallis agreed.
Right? So, Dave, what's your next steps?
Next step, for sure, is to schedule a meeting with a subgroup, work group, whatever you call ourselves, to sit down and start talking specifically about how we want to approach Dexter trapping, outlanding next year. And we're going to bring in UBI into that conversation. So that's the next step as regards that. Meeting notes will be coming out. We'll probably be having another meeting. Oh my heavens! Sometime after Thanksgiving, I guess. And then Willamette Science Reviews coming up. I believe the first week in February. So Cameron, I'm going to be needing to sit down and have some conversations with you at some point about.
Explain to me how I'm supposed to give a talk about each subbasin separately.
I'm
just going to give the whole meeting over to me.
That
doesn't make any sense. Yeah,
I know not to talk about. If you have some serious reservations, I would let somebody know fast because you're not alone. But it's either going to go really well or it's going to go really bizarrely. I can't figure out which. Anyways, that's the thought. So thank you all so much for the meeting and for coming down.
Cool.
And wherever Jerry is, thank you for this tour. It was pretty awesome to see this facility. Yeah. See you all next time.
Let's not leave any trash around.
So we're working on our McKenzie comments back to you guys on the technical assessment. It should be out.
Okay. Okay. That's the weird quantifying. And then the production planning has got us.
You're done.
Start showing up.
Yeah. You're obviously on the mailing list. You're there with me.